The process of producing a Massachusetts state budget for the fiscal year that starts July 1st is proceeding on schedule on Beacon Hill, unlike last year when financial uncertainties surrounding the pandemic delayed the final budget for months. On Tuesday, the state Senate Ways and Means Committee recommended a $47.6 billion budget. It's nearly identical to what the House passed last month. It's about $2 million more than the budget Governor Charlie Baker proposed. WAMC's Pioneer Valley Bureau Chief Paul Tuthill spoke with State Senator Eric Lesser, who represents the 1st Hamden and Hampshire District.
Well, I think it's a very strong budget for a variety of reasons. First, just, you know, thinking back to where we were this time last year in April and May of 2020, if someone had said then that a year from then, from that point, we would have a budget with 3.5% growth, with key investments in education, key investments in eradicating childhood poverty, key investments in mental health and in hospital supports, and that we would be able to continue to maintain a very high stabilization fund in the process and even build in a surplus, I think you would have thought that that was fantastical thinking, but that is where we are. There are certainly significant unmet needs, significant challenges that remain from COVID, but what this budget does show is that the state's fiscal position is very strong.
Friday, I believe, is the deadline for submitting amendments. There was some discussion of extending that, but are you planning to propose any amendments?
I'll be proposing many amendments, as I do every year. We're in the process of preparing those right now. And you know, we actually have an extra week this week because of the later Memorial Day, because Memorial Day is a little bit later on the calendar. There'll be an extra week of kind of preparation and deliberation before the final week of May, which is when we'll be debating the amendments and finalizing the Senate's plan.
Funding earmarks for local projects, local programs are important to every state senator and state representative. What are your priorities in that area?
Well, for me, you know, my funding priorities, my budget priorities remain what they've always been, which is recovery and reinvestment after COVID-19 and helping recover some of our hardest hit sectors. That includes tourism, hospitality, restaurant industry, travel industry. It includes making sure Western Mass gets its fair share for issues like hospital reimbursements, healthcare spending, support for our homeless shelters, support for our women and children programs, support for housing. It also means, you know, some maybe smaller but still really important programs to our quality of life here in Western Mass, like the Community Music School or the Zoo in Forest Park, also get their fair share of support from the state.
Does this budget take into account any of the billions of dollars that Massachusetts is in line to receive from the Federal American Rescue Plan?
So a great question. It does not include the money that is set aside or coming to Massachusetts from the American Rescue Plan that was passed by the Biden administration and Congress earlier this year. It does include some significant money from FEMA and from some other federal programs, but the new money that was approved earlier this year as part of the American Rescue Plan is not part of this budget, which again is an indication of just how strong and how prudent the budget writers have been. We felt strongly that one-time revenues like a rescue plan should not be baked into operating expenses for the state that come up year after year. So this FY22 budget, which will cover the state's expenses from July to July, will not include the rescue plan funds. We will be having a separate process for determining the investments that the rescue funds coming from Washington should go to.
And when will that be? I know that the Treasury Department is working on the final rules as to what exactly this can be spent on. When do you anticipate that you'll be having this separate debate on how to spend the federal money?
So we were waiting on federal guidance, you know, details about what the money could and couldn't be used for, and also some details about the timeline of the spending requirements. And we are getting that this week. In fact, it's already started to come from the Federal Treasury Department in Washington. So as we get that information, and as our administration and finance department, and as the both House and Senate Ways and Means Committees get that information, we're going to be incorporating that into the plans moving forward. I'd also point out that there do remain significant unanticipated and large liabilities from COVID that we still do need to respond to, and that we need resources to respond to. So I think a prudent approach of really making sure that we have a full understanding of the scope of the whole from COVID-19 is going to be important. You know, one example of this is the very significant assessments that businesses are facing across the state, many in Western Mass, around the solvency fund for unemployment insurance. There's many businesses seeing, you know, many factor increases in their solvency fund assessments over previous years. That's one area where, for example, I'd like to see some state support.
The House version of the budget did not include projected revenue from legalizing sports betting. Does the Senate version include it?
The Senate version does not include sports betting, but the Economic Development Committee is going to be working and continuing to work on sports betting through the spring and summer. I am hopeful that we do a sports betting bill, but it wasn't ready for the budget.
The funding to build a new Holyoke Soldiers Home, that's not in this budget, but both the House and Senate passed separate bond bills. The Senate's version was about $200 million more than the House version. There were some other differences. I know it's in a conference committee now. Are you, is it your belief that everything will be reconciled and finalized in order to meet this August 1st deadline that's looming to get the plans submitted to the federal government to get the reimbursement for the construction costs?
Well, I certainly hope so. Our veterans deserve a first-rate facility. The reports and the sort of after-action analyses of what happened at the Soldiers' Home, which, by the way, a horrific tragedy of national proportions. And one of the hardest things I've done in the state Senate is speak to many of my constituents who had loved ones at that facility and who have struggled, you know, since then to put their lives back together after losing loved ones there. But what I would, you know, say on that is it has to get done. And I've made clear that this is a very top priority for me. I know I share that priority with many of my colleagues in the Western Mass delegation. Frankly, the differences are, while they are very big on maybe on paper, are really not particular stumbling blocks, I don't think. The $200 million in extra funding is for authorizations. It does not require that the money be spent. It simply authorizes in law some flexibility for the administration to appropriate funds, for example, for smaller veterans' homes, you know, maybe 5-10 unit homes in more localized communities around the state to help fill some gaps we've got in veterans' housing and veterans' care. And I think that those kinds of issues can be reconciled, and we can get that done before the deadline.
You were a couple months ago a very vocal critic of the Baker administration's rollout of the COVID-19 vaccines in Massachusetts. How do you think we're doing now?
Well, we're certainly doing much better, and the big change was a couple things. First, there was really a federalization of the vaccine rollout in the sense that the retail pharmacies, CVS, Walmart, Walgreens, and many others, really ramped up their distribution of the vaccine through direct sourcing by the federal government. There was also a FEMA site that was authorized in Boston that dramatically scaled up the number of doses. And there were finally significant improvements done to the website and to the customer service interface on a state level. Now you've actually seen you've seen this play out in the sense that now most people are getting their vaccine through a more localized source, whether it's a local pharmacy or a local board of health. The state is actually closing those mass vaccination sites. So it's done a lot better, but it frankly, I don't think that we would have seen the improvement if the legislature hadn't taken as strong a stand as it did.
What needs to be done to improve the vaccination rate in Hampden County, which lags badly the state as a whole?
Yeah, well, that's a great example of, you know, the mindset really needs to be, instead of people coming to the vaccine, bringing the vaccine to people. So I would like to see a much more localized approach. The Springfield Health and Human Services Department and Helen McCullough Harris, the commissioner, have done a fantastic job with this. They need more support. They need more resources, both from the state and the federal government. And we need to work to empower local community leaders, whether it's clergy, community figures, business leaders, nonprofit leaders, or, you know, even things, people like athletic coaches or teachers at school or primary care doctors. We need to move to a new phase of the vaccine rollout where those local on-the-ground leaders are empowered, because they tend to be the people who are the most trusted.
Should state employees be required to be vaccinated, especially if their jobs bring them into direct contact with members of the public?
I'm not ready to make a commitment like that just yet. I'm certainly open to that if there are particular cases where other people could be endangered, you know, maybe in a sensitive healthcare environment or a nursing home, something like that. I think generally speaking, people are tending to get the vaccine, even if they might be a little bit hesitant at the beginning. People are tending to get the vaccine if and when they receive, you know, proper education about it and get guidance from people that they trust in their circles, whether it's their own primary care doctor or their own community figures or people in their own family networks who they trust. So my preference is to use those mechanisms first before you use the blunt instrument of a mandate.
But you're not adamantly opposed to that then?
No, I mean, I think it's premature right now to have that conversation because, frankly, the state hasn't done the work it needs to do yet to do that kind of ground-level engagement with people. So let's see where that leads first.
Last question. I know you had a live stream recently with a couple of top tourism officials, Mary Kay Wydra from here in Western Massachusetts, and the person in charge of tourism in the Greater Boston area, whose name
Sheridan. Yes.
I'm sorry, what's her name?
Martha Sheridan.
Sheridan. That's it. I couldn't think of her name. I know that the tourism industry folks have been concerned about losing a substantial portion of the summer if the state doesn't fully reopen until August 1st. Would you like to see the state fully reopen before this August 1st target date that the Governor Baker has set?
Well, I'm curious about the August 1st date, and frankly, we haven't really gotten the explanations we need from the governor or from the Department of Public Health about why they chose that date. It feels arbitrary to kind of circle a date on a calendar like that, especially since our neighboring states, New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Jersey, you know, all that had similar virus numbers and similar case counts and similar kind of penetration of the virus in their states that we had, and unfortunately similar death counts as well. Their reopenings seem to be much earlier in May and June. So we frankly just don't have enough of an explanation from them about why that August 1st date was chosen. I think something that was very interesting about the takeaway from that conversation is so many of the things that before COVID tended to work against Western Mass in this post-COVID world or entering post-COVID world will seem to be working in favor of Western Mass in terms of tourism recovery. One of the interesting takeaways from that was in Western Mass, our tourism market is more outdoors. There's a lot more outdoor attractions, natural open space that people recreate in, and that's more popular in a post-COVID recovery. We also have a much greater share of people visiting from relatively local locations, whether it's Boston, New York, the Mid-Atlantic states, and they tend to come by car rather than flights. And we know air travel is going to be slower to recover than car travel. And also we have less of a dependence on an international tourist and international travel is certainly going to be one of the last pieces to recover. Boston is really the inverse. It's a large conference market, lot of business travelers. Western Mass tends to be more of a personal traveler. The Boston market, much more dependent on air travel and very dependent also on international. So because of that, you know, I think you're going to see a sort of split screen recovery here in the sense that Western Mass tourism is going to recover at a much faster clip than the Boston-based tourism.
And getting the agricultural fairs, especially the Big E back, will be big, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would assume that the Big E will be a green light if August 1st is the date that the occupancy limits are lifted. That would mean under that guidance that the Big E would be able to operate, and that is very, very important for the economy in Western Mass. As we pointed out in that live stream, more than 1 million visitors coming through West Springfield over the 3-week fair. The fact that that did not happen this past year was devastating for a lot of people who rely on that income.